In the summer of 1985, Kevin resurfaced, nearly a year after his disappearance and just a few weeks after his arrest warrant expired. Bob Ewan was shocked to learn that the Juvenile Probation Department had dropped the warrant from its books with no explanation. If Ewan had known that the warrant was going to dissolve, he would have insisted on an extension. The investigator knew that if he had been working the case steadily instead of spottily, he would have found Kevin no matter where he had gone. Lenny didn't find out that Kevin was back in L.A. until he got a call one day at work. When he picked up the receiver, all he heard was someone pushing touchtone keys. The caller was spelling out his own name using a private code that Lenny immediately recognized. The kid who had escaped the law was back in town, possibly up to his old tricks. Kevin finally spoke up, and the second chapter of the DeSico-Mitnick partnership began. Kevin said very little to Lenny about his time spent underground. From what he did say, Lenny figured that Kevin had cobbled together a false ID or two, gathered his bar mitzvah money, and caught the first plane out of L.A. But even when Lenny tried to goad him years later into telling him where he had been, Kevin wouldn't say. When Kevin returned, Lenny was working on the 4-to-midnight shift as a computer operator for Hughes Aircraft Radar Systems Group in El Segundo. It was his fifth job in 2 years. Well-spoken and relaxed during interviews, Lenny was a master at talking himself into any position. His habit of abusing his employee privileges, however, would surface soon enough, and what his family referred to as Lenny's computer shenanigans usually drove his supervisors to fire him after only a few months. Whenever Lenny got a new job, Kevin wanted to know what computers were there. A digital computer was a good start. A dial-up line that allowed access to the computer from the outside was even better. And if Lenny was working a job with night hours and could get Kevin in when everyone else had left for the day, then Lenny heard from him just about every day. Kevin had a new project in mind, establishing accounts on the score of minicomputers that Pacific Bell operated in Los Angeles for order entry. Looking back several years later, Lenny decided that when they were dabbling in the minis, as telephone company personnel referred to them, they gathered more power than they had ever had or would ever see again. Someone with access to these computers, which connect to switches controlling all Los Angeles telephone service, could enter commands and see them take effect immediately. The switches accessible through the minis did everything from discontinuing service on a line to initiating a trace. It was Lenny's job to put computer equipment at Kevin's disposal. Without a badge, Kevin couldn't come into the premises at Hughes. Once, however, in April of 1986, he managed to talk the guard into letting him in. During this, Kevin's first and last visit to Hughes, he logged on to Dockmaster, a computer run by the National Computer Security Center, a division of the National Security Agency, the nation's highly secretive intelligence agency. Despite its obvious appeal to the adventuresome pair, Dockmaster didn't harbor any deep national security secrets. It was simply NSA's public bridge to the outside world. To get onto Dockmaster, Kevin had found the name of someone outside the NSA with a guest account. Posing as a technician at an NSA computer center, Kevin had telephoned the legitimate user and said he was issuing new passwords and needed some information. Name, telephone, and current password. It was an old trick that Kevin and Roscoe had refined together, and it usually worked like a charm. But Dockmaster was incidental, a diversion from the Pacific Bell Minis project. Since he couldn't come to Hughes, Kevin telephoned his instructions to Lenny. He called constantly. "It's the wife," Lenny's partner in the computer room would joke when he handed Lenny the phone. And when they needed to devote 24 hours at a stretch to their work, they checked in to one of the dozens of cut-rate motels along Sepulveda Boulevard in the heart of the San Fernando Valley. It was pure cyberpunk. The mile-long strip of seedy shelters was a magnet for local prostitution and drug rings, but neither Kevin nor Lenny cared, as long as the motel room had a telephone line that could be transformed into a data communication center. Once that criterion was met, Lenny preferred motels with pools in case he got the urge for exercise, and both were partial to places next to a 7-Eleven or other suitable convenience stores for frequent junk food runs. Kevin usually plunked down the 1995 for the night onto the registration desk in coins filched from Shelley's tip money from waitressing. Once inside the room, they went straight to work. Kevin unpacked the terminal while Lenny popped open his toolset to rig the telephone jack so that it would accommodate their modem. They worked through the night, taking little note of some of the seamier activities around them. They often pushed the checkout time to the limit until the manager came round to throw them out, making them persona non grata at that establishment. It took 6 months for them to get fully privileged accounts on every phone company mini in the Los Angeles area, and with each computer they conquered, their potential power increased. It would not have been difficult for Kevin and Lenny to take down the phone service for the entire metropolitan area, but neither of them was interested in that. The idea of power was more seductive than actually wielding it. When Hughes got word from the NSA that someone from the El Segundo facility had been into the Dockmaster computer, Hughes' management went on a witch hunt. The night of the penetration was linked to Kevin's visit. Mitnick was linked to Lenny, and Lenny was summarily dismissed. The company's corporate security department spent the days after Lenny's departure behind closed doors, conducting intensive interviews with anyone Lenny had associated with. After Lenny was fired from Hughes, he got a job as a delivery man for a flower shop. The only vital credential was a perfect driving record. Though only 20, Lenny already had a formidable record of outstanding traffic warrants. But that was Leonard Mitchell DeSico's problem. The florist hired Robert Andrew Bollinger, a model motorist. As Lenny would later tell the story, with Kevin's help, he had created a new identity for himself. He even went so far as to rent an apartment in the San Fernando Valley as Mr. Bollinger. But a florist doesn't have much need for a Vax minicomputer, the mainstay of Digital's product lines and Kevin's target of choice. Now Lenny hardly heard from Kevin at all. The intensity of this friendship, Lenny realized, waxed and waned depending upon his job. The degree of Kevin's loyalty was a function of the kind of equipment Lenny could provide. Bollinger quit the flower delivery business after 1 month. Lenny DeSico resurfaced as a computer operator for a shipping company. For the time being, Kevin kept a low profile. He seemed to have become more paranoid since his return. Kevin had always been secretive about disclosing personal data. It wasn't until months after Lenny met him that he was even willing to give Lenny his home telephone number. But now he was acting strangely. He was taken with the idea that people should be able to contact him at any time, but without his having to reveal his whereabouts. So he started carrying a pocket pager everywhere he went, and both Lenny and Roscoe noticed that the more paranoid Kevin became, the more he ate. Perhaps in an effort to follow Roscoe's path into the world of conventional computing, in September of 1985, Kevin enrolled at the Computer Learning Center of Los Angeles. Roscoe had graduated a few years earlier and spoke well of it. Kevin's previous experience in higher education had been dismal. In 1982, he was expelled from Pierce College, a 2-year community college in the heart of the San Fernando Valley, for tampering with the school's computers. Maybe this time he could keep his mind on the coursework. The Computer Learning Center was started in the 1960s by a group of computer executives who, astutely enough, predicted that the nascent computer industry would see explosive growth in years to come and would need tens of thousands of people qualified to fill the jobs that were emerging. By the late 1970s, the computer industry was a major source of white-collar employment, not unlike the consumer electronics industry when it mushroomed in the 1950s and 60s. And just like any other technical school advertised on matchbook covers and city buses, the Computer Learning Center wanted to attract a student body hungry for work. To gain admission to CLC, a prospective student needed a high school diploma or equivalency degree. The applicant then took a basic aptitude test designed to measure ability in symbolic logic and mathematical reasoning, the foundations of computer science. The $3,000 tuition for the 9-month program was paid in advance, and the student was on the way to a fresh career. CLC graduates, many of whom were retooled English majors or auto mechanics, joined the data processing ranks inside Security Pacific Bank and the dozens of giant aerospace corporations that dotted the Los Angeles basin. Polaroid snapshots of these successful graduates were enshrined in a glass display case upstairs at CLC. And next to the first floor admissions office, letters of glowing commendation from such satisfied employers as First Interstate Bank, Continental Airlines, and Agfa Cravat lined the walls. Although the school failed to offer its graduates a formal degree, as a technical school, it could certify would-be technicians and programmers as proficient in using the center's computers. For the most part, corporate America didn't need computer science PhDs fresh out of UCLA, Stanford, or Caltech, as much as it needed young men and women willing to work a lobster shift, changing tapes to back up the day's business for a starting salary of $20,000. The Computer Learning Center was a steady source of entry-level programmers, technicians, computer operators, and data entry clerks for the region. If not exactly the glamour posts of the computer industry, these jobs at least paid better than other clerical positions that required less training. The Computer Learning Center was a resolutely straight, no-nonsense place. Its dress code forbade all but the most businesslike attire. Like so many scrub-faced Mormon missionaries, the men were required to wear jackets and ties, the women, skirts or dress pants. Larry Jair, who taught an introductory class at CLC in the COBOL computer language, was vaguely aware of Kevin Mitnick's past problems. But he tried to treat him like any other student. Kevin was inquisitive, and his mind always seemed to be working at least a lecture's worth ahead of the class. Kevin had an unusual mix of computer expertise. There were some fundamentals he didn't know, but in other areas he was well ahead of his fellow students. He displayed so much ability, in fact, that Jair was concerned that an entry-level job wouldn't challenge him. Jair adopted the role of teacher-counselor to this erratic student. He tried to encourage Kevin, telling him that if he could get a good entry-level job and show what he could do, he would rise swiftly.